Did you know it's now 45 years since the launch of the Mars 2 spacecraft? Yes, Mars 2, you say? I've never heard of it. Well, it was launched in 1971, May the 19th, and reached Mars in November of that year. It was supposed to land on Mars softly and transmit pictures back to Earth. But unfortunately, when it arrived there on November the 27th, it crashed. Boom, smash, gone. Well, the Russians launched another one just a few days after the first, May 19 for Mars 2, and then Mars 3 was launched on May 28, and it arrived at Mars on December the 2nd of that year. And lo and behold, it made a soft landing. Yay! But it went into a dust storm. Oh. And a partial picture was returned, but then the thing was overwhelmed by the dust and was never heard from again. So there we have it, the anniversary this week of Mars 2 and Mars 3, both from the Soviet Union. Well, let's move on a little now to the MAVEN spacecraft. Now, MAVEN didn't land on Mars, but it went into orbit around Mars. And we have a few little pointers here about it. And in this case, we're going to be looking at the design of a spacecraft to orbit Mars and study its atmosphere.
With the MAVEN spacecraft just now reaching Mars, it's easy to think that NASA and its partners simply unwrapped a new space vehicle and sent it on its way. Nothing could be further from the truth. Every time humanity sends a probe out into space, that vehicle has to be carefully designed and constructed, piece by piece. Now, that doesn't mean every spacecraft starts from absolute scratch, however. There are a variety of commonly used parts and designs that can be the basis of each new vehicle. But by and large, every spacecraft is handcrafted. MAVEN's design is a direct result of focused collaboration among all of its partners. Science goals drove design, and then form followed function. Two instruments were built at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Four at the University of California at Berkeley, and two at the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado. Lockheed Martin Space Systems was involved from the earliest stages of the project and had the role of the spacecraft's design, not to mention being the place where the vehicle came together.
And we now look at a question asked about this spacecraft by a member of the media.
Or why is it important to understand what has happened to the Martian atmosphere?
One of the really overarching questions about Mars is whether there was ever life, what the history of life has been. Life by itself is not easy to identify, is not easy to understand, and we're trying to understand the context in which life might have existed. Any life on Mars interacts with its planetary environment. We need to know the what that environment is and how it's evolved over time. MAVEN is about looking at the history of the atmosphere in order to understand the history of that environment. So it's really telling us the boundary conditions that surround the potential for life. By understanding the processes by which the atmosphere changed, we're learning about the history of the habitability of Mars. And by looking at Mars relative to Earth and Venus, we're learning about the nature of planets and the history of atmospheres in general. With the discovery of planets around other stars, this lets us extrapolate beyond our own solar system to the history of planets, the potential for life in the galaxy at large.
Now, having sent unmanned spacecraft, and Mars 2 was the first spacecraft to land on Mars, albeit not successfully. Mars 3, yeah, sort of successfully, but it failed straight away. What about jumping ahead and saying, okay, that's the first unmanned spacecraft, but what about a spacecraft with people on it? Well, that is a long way away, unless, of course, you believe Josh Richards. Now, he's an astronaut and a candidate to be one of the first people to live on Mars. He has applied on the project called Mars One. Now, Josh comes from here in Melbourne, and we have a listen now to our conversation with Josh about what Mars One is and his hopes to be one of the first Martians. Welcome to the Space Show, Josh.
Thank you for having us. It's great to be here.
What is Mars One?
So Mars One is an international not-for-profit organisation based in the Netherlands, and they have the stated goal of colonising Mars.
And how do they plan to do that?
Over a while. It's going to take a little while to do it. I suppose the primary thing most people know of Mars One, because they have the plan of sending people one way. It is a colonisation mission. They're sending them essentially there to stay, and we're not going to have the return vehicles. We're not going to have those sort of technologies that people like NASA or ESA have talked about. We're going there to live permanently on the surface.
So it's not a suicide mission?
See, it's interesting. People turn around and call it a suicide mission. I guess you could call living on Earth a suicide mission, because you're going to die here eventually as well. So, it's interesting hearing people call it that. We are going to another planet to die, but hopefully not on impact, and hopefully not for quite some time.
Yes. So there must be parallels then between the migrants who have travelled from one country to another, knowing that they're not going to come back, for example, from Europe to Australia.
Yeah, there's definitely sort of parallels there. I suppose when the migrants were leaving those areas to come to, say, Australia or the US, they knew that there was oxygen in the US or in Australia. But other than that, there's definitely parallels. There's definitely the idea of being a pioneer, going somewhere you've never been before, having to build the infrastructure, having to build the systems that will essentially keep you living. Having to support all of that. So it's definitely harks back to that kind of that time of being a pioneer.
Will you actually be growing your own food there, getting water from there, or will you need to be supplied from Earth?
So when we arrive initially, there'll be about 6 years' worth of food waiting for us that's been sent as part of supplies. But the very first thing we're going to be doing is trying to grow our own food. The idea is to try and sort of establish some form of independence from Earth. So the idea is, start growing our own food. We'll be extracting water out of the soil to provide oxygen, to provide water for us to drink and bathe and all those sort of things. And the idea is to be as independent as possible. There'll be some things that we need resupplied, but we're trying to essentially set up a sustainable colony that's independent.
Well, Josh, could you take us through a sort of a timeline? Training, launch, journey on Mars.
Yes, sure. So the next stage for me, I suppose, in terms of the training side of things, we have 100 candidates in the running currently. They're going to cut that group down to 24. It will be September next year. We essentially get all 100 together and see how we work together in teams, work together as groups. There'll be significant cuts very early on in the 2 week assessment phase, and then they'll stick probably about 40 of us in some sort of isolation and see how we operate under that. Then put us through quite an extensive interview, and they'll pick 24 of us to become full-time employees to start training for the 10 years that it's going to take before we're slated to launch in September 2026. Before that happens, we need to work on a whole series of different systems. Essentially, we're going to be sending a probe that's based on the NASA Phoenix lander that essentially was scouting out water on the North Pole. We'll be sending that to where we think would be the best place to set up a colony, checking that there's water, checking that the resources that we're going to need are there in place, and testing a few technologies at the same time. If it proves to be the right place, that lander then becomes a beacon that we start sending supplies to. So start sending life support systems, start sending habitats, all of that that will then be set up robotically by rovers. Once we've got a fully functioning colony on the surface of Mars with reserves of oxygen, with a livable habitat waiting for humans, then we'll be getting inside a capsule, and we'll have four of us that are launching from there. But no one's going to be leaving low Earth orbit until we've got somewhere safe to go that's been effectively set up by robots. So however long that takes, we will change the timeline to make sure it's safe for people.
So the first crew is crew of four. Yeah. Followed by?
Followed by another crew 26 months later, hopefully. So the idea is that the crews are selected based on how they get along with each other. There's a few basic requirements like being over 18, being fit and healthy, and being able to get along with people, and they were the basic requirements to apply in the first place. From there, Mars One have essentially selected the folks that they think have the best personality. It's not about skills, it's not about experience or things like that. It's about how you relate to other people. So you actually want someone who gets along really well in a shared house rather than someone who's an amazing fighter pilot and things like that. You can train people to learn the skills that they need to learn. You can't necessarily teach them to get along with other people really well. So we'll hopefully have, the idea is to have two men and two women, and they will be representing four corners of the globe, regardless of where anyone was born, representing all of the planet.
How long will the journey take to get to Mars?
So the September 2026 window, the alignment there works out to about 210 days for us, so it's roughly 7 months trip. That window varies a little bit with each sort of alignment, but ours will be 210 days.
Mm. Launch vehicle.
There's a lot of talk about different launch vehicles. Mars One have designed one themselves. They had an architect, space architect, who worked alongside them for quite a few years, and he essentially designed a transit habitat. There's a lot of discussion about who and what we would use, but the reality is it's quite a few years off before we'd need to make a decision like that. Mars One's very much focused on the basics, getting the basics right, finding the appropriate landing site, making sure we can get supplies there in the first place, and then we'll start working sort of work out how we're going to get there. Do the basics first.
So realistically, as things stand at the moment, there's Arianespace, the Ariane 5, there's India, perhaps, or China. The United States, yeah.
Well, I think the one that everyone's very excited about, particularly in the States, and again, there's been no official agreement between Mars One and this organisation yet, but I know a lot of people are very excited about the Falcon Heavy launch that's slated for early next year through SpaceX, and I suspect that if any organisation is going to support people colonising Mars, it'll be Elon Musk and SpaceX.
Now, Josh, what's your background that you bring to this?
I have a very diverse background. I haven't stayed in one area for particularly long. I originally studied applied physics and psychology at university, graduated, and then sort of I'd been spending time with the Army prior to that, and did a little bit more time working as a combat engineer. So my background's very much in explosives and that side of things. I worked in the mines for 12 months as an explosives engineer. I then got back into the military, went and served with the British Commandos for about 12 months, bounced around and did a whole bunch of things. So I worked for an artist in the UK for most of a year as his science advisor. I suppose the job that most people know me for, though, is having worked as a stand-up comic. I started comedy in 2008, from memory. It may even have been the end of 2007. But, worked in stand-up comedy for quite some time, and that's actually how I discovered Mars One in the first place. I had decided to write a comedy show about sending people one way to Mars, and I discovered an organisation trying to do it. So rather than saying we should do this, I put my hand up to do it.
Well, it's a long time till launch. What are you planning to do in the meantime?
I suppose I'm still working in comedy. That's the big thing for me. I've got a part-time job at the moment working in a school as a lab manager, but next year it's very much about getting back into stand-up. And interestingly enough, the show that I'm writing at the moment for, you know, the Adelaide Fringe and the Melbourne Comedy Festival next year is based around answering exactly that question. Turn around and going, if you've got 10 years left to live on Earth, what would you do with your time? If you knew that it was all going to be finished in 10 years, what experiences would you want to have? What kind of relationships do you have? What sort of answering all of those kind of questions? So, yeah, it's actually the premise of my next show.
Well, we'll have to keep up with you then and see what you're doing.
Thank you. It'll be good.
Well, thanks for joining us, Josh, on the Space Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Josh Richards. As you heard, a candidate for the Mars One trip to Mars. Of course, many people don't think that's actually going to happen. anytime soon. Because after all, we're looking back 45 years ago this week to the Mars 2 and 3 launches to Mars, the first craft to land on Mars. And some people would say, well, we've got to look another 45 years into the future before we'll get humans there. Well, someone who's doing something about making this happen is James Ruther. He's a Deputy Associate Administrator in the Space Technology Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters, which is in Washington, D.C. He's developing the technologies needed to support future human exploration of Mars.
There's many technologies that are necessary if we're actually going to send humans to Mars. These technologies support those capabilities. One of those is, how do we get there and get back? If we tried to take everything that we need to live or to get down to the surface of Mars and get back up and get home, to do that with conventional rockets would require the vast amount of mass that you would take up into space to be the propellant to just get to and from Mars. And so in order to reduce that and make trips to Mars more affordable, one of the key technologies that we're working on is solar electric propulsion. Now, solar electric propulsion has been around for a while. We're actually using it on the Dawn mission. It's used on many commercial satellites today to do station keeping. But the kind of solar electric propulsion, the high-powered solar electric propulsion that's necessary in order to take cargo and logistics and accommodations to Mars requires a significant step up in the capability of solar electric propulsion relative to where we are today. And that's one of the key technologies that the Space Technology Mission Directorate is working on in conjunction with HEO. And the advantage of working on this high-powered solar electric propulsion is that it's also a benefit to the commercial space industry, and it is a direct benefit to the Science Mission Directorate as well. So all of these different elements within NASA and within the space enterprise are going to benefit from the efforts to work on solar electric propulsion. In addition to solar electric propulsion, which gets things very efficiently, 5 to 10 times more efficient than chemical propulsion to and from Mars, we also have to figure out how to get down to the surface of Mars. This we refer to as EDL, or entry, descent, and landing. The technologies that we have to get to the Mars surface today are capable of putting something like the Curiosity spacecraft that down to the surface, and that's about 1 metric ton or 1,000 kilograms down to the Mars surface. However, to do things much more significant in mass, such as putting a crewed capsule down to the surface of Mars, requires us to have EDL technologies that we do not have in hand today. And there are several different elements of this. Just like the Curiosity landing, you have to go through an entry phase where you have to use the atmosphere to slow yourself down, and then a propulsive descent stage and a final landing stage. All three elements require technology developments to be able to do human crewed missions to Mars. And the Space Technology Mission Directorate is working on those technologies today so that when we do eventually send our folks to Mars, or if science decides to go to larger payloads to the surface of Mars, we will have those technologies ready to go at that point. The last element that I was going to discuss is that in order to do deep space human missions, and in fact more capable science missions, we also have to work on the communications to and from our spacecraft. Today we use Ka band radio transmission to take information to and from Mars, and we could do about 20 megabytes per second as a maximum capability, and we need to be able to do 10 times or even 100 times that capability. That really is not currently feasible with standard radio transmissions, and so we're working on what's called laser communications or optical communications that will, for the same power level, allow us to do 10 times or even 100 times the bandwidth of communications. And certainly if you're having astronauts there that are capable of gathering significant amounts of science data compared to our robotic missions today, having that higher bandwidth in communications becomes essential. But in partnership with science, mission directorate today, even they are looking for substantially greater capability in optical communication. So we're partnered with both mission directorates to advance those technologies. We are also looking at composite structures and how they are implemented.
And that was James Ruther, Deputy Associate Administrator, Space Technology Mission Directorate. So, will it be 45 years in the future, as some suggest, or could it be sooner, as Josh hopes for? Well, we'll find out in due course, no doubt, and the Space Show will keep following that story.